G. Gurdjieff, All and Everything. 10 books in 3 series, of which this is the first series. The Preface. Original written in Russian and Armenian. Translations into other languages have been made under the personal direction of the author by a group of translators chosen by him and specially trained according to their defined individualities in conformity with the text to be translated and in relation to the philological particularities of each language. First series, 3 books under the title of an objectively impartial criticism of the life of man, or Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. Second series, 3 books under the common title of Meetings with Remarkable Men. Third series, 4 books under the common title of Life is Real Only Then When I Am. All written according to entirely new principles of logical reasoning and strictly directed towards the solution of the following 3 cardinal problems. First series. To destroy mercilessly, without any compromises whatsoever, in the mentation and feelings of the reader, the beliefs and views by centuries rooted in him about everything existing in the world. Second series. To acquaint the reader with the material required for a new creation and to prove the soundness and good quality of it. Third series. To assist the arising, in the mentation and in the feelings of the reader, of a veritable, non-fantastic representation, not of that illusory world which he now perceives, but of the world existing in reality. Friendly advice. Written impromptu by the author on delivering this book, already prepared for publication, to the printer. According to the numerous deductions and conclusions made by me during experimental elucidations concerning the productivity of the perception by contemporary people of new impressions from what is heard and read, and also according to the thought of one of the sayings of popular wisdom I have just remembered, handed down to our days from very ancient times, which declares, any prayer may be heard by the higher powers and a corresponding answer obtained only if it is uttered thrice. Firstly, for the welfare or the peace of the souls of one's parents. Secondly, for the welfare of one's neighbour. And only thirdly, for oneself personally. I find it necessary, on the first page of this book, quite ready for publication, to give the following advice. Read each of my written expositions thrice. Firstly, at least as you have already become mechanized to read all your contemporary books and newspapers. Secondly, as if you were reading aloud to another person. And only thirdly, try and fathom the gist of my writings. Only then will you be able to count upon forming your own impartial judgment proper to yourself alone on my writings, and only then can my hope be actualized that according to your understanding you will obtain the specific benefit for yourself which I anticipate, and which I wish for you with all my being. Chapter 1. the arousing of thought. Among other convictions formed in my common presence during my responsible, peculiarly composed life, there is one such also, an indubitable conviction, that always and everywhere on the earth, among people of every degree of development of understanding and of every form of manifestation of the factors which engender in their individuality all kinds of ideals, there is acquired the tendency, when beginning anything new, unfailingly to pronounce aloud, or if not aloud, at least mentally, that definite utterance, understandable to every even quite illiterate person, which in different epochs has been formulated variously, and in our day is formulated in the following words: In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and in the name of the Holy Ghost. Amen. That is why I now, also, setting forth on this venture quite new for me, namely, authorship, begin by pronouncing this utterance, and moreover, pronounce it not only aloud, but even very distinctly, and with a full, as the ancient Thulesites defined it, wholly manifested intonation. Of course, with that fullness which can arise in my entirety only from data already formed and thoroughly rooted in me for such a manifestation. Data which are in general formed in the nature of man, by the way, during his preparatory age, and later during his responsible life, engender in him the ability for the manifestation of the nature and vivifyingness of such an intonation. Having thus begun, I can now be quite at ease, and should even, according to the notions of religious morality existing among contemporary people, be beyond all doubt assured that everything further in this new venture of mine will now proceed, as is said, like a pianola. In any case, I have begun just thus, and as to how the rest will go, I can only say meanwhile, as the blind man once expressed it, we shall see. First and foremost, I shall place my own hand, moreover the right one, which, although at the moment it is slightly injured owing to the misfortune which recently befell me, is nevertheless really my own, and has never once failed me in all my life, on my heart, of course also my own. But on the inconstancy or constancy of this part of all my whole, I do not find it necessary here to expatiate, and frankly confess that I myself have personally not the slightest wish to write, but attendant circumstances, quite independent of me, constrain me to do so. And whether these circumstances arose accidentally, or were created intentionally by extraneous forces, I myself do not yet know. I know only that these circumstances bid me write not just anything so-so, as, for instance, something of the kind for reading oneself to sleep, but weighty and bulky tomes. However that may be, I begin. But begin with what? Oh, the devil! Will there indeed be repeated that same exceedingly unpleasant and highly strange sensation which it befell me to experience when about 3 weeks ago I was composing in my thoughts the scheme and sequence of the ideas destined by me for publication and did not know then how to begin either? This sensation then experienced, I might now formulate in words only thus: the fear of drowning in the overflow of my own thoughts. To stop this undesirable sensation, I might then still have had recourse to the aid of that maleficent property existing also in me, as in contemporary man, which has become inherent in all of us, and which enables us, without experiencing any remorse of conscience whatever, to put off anything we wish to do till tomorrow. I could then have done this very easily, because before beginning the actual writing, it was assumed that there was still lots of time, but this can now no longer be done, and I must, without fail, as is said, even though I burst, begin. But with what indeed begin? Hurrah! Eureka! Almost all the books I have happened to read in my life have begun with a preface. So, in this case, I also must begin with something of the kind. I say of the kind, because in general, in the process of my life, from the moment I began to distinguish a boy from a girl, I have always done everything, absolutely everything, not as it is done by other, like myself, biped destroyers of nature's good. Therefore, in writing now, I ought, and perhaps am even on principle already obliged, to begin not as any other writer would. In any case, instead of the conventional preface, I shall begin quite simply with a warning. Beginning with a warning will be very judicious of me, if only because it will not contradict any of my principles, either organic, psychic, or even willful, and will at the same time be quite honest. Of course, honest in the objective sense, because both I myself and all others who know me well expect with indubitable certainty that owing to my writings, they will entirely disappear in the majority of readers immediately and not gradually, as must sooner or later with time occur to all people, all the wealth they have, which was either handed down to them by inheritance or obtained by their own labour, in the form of quieting notions, evoking only naive dreams, and also beautiful representations of their lives at present, as well as of their prospects in the future. Professional writers usually begin such introductions with an address to the reader, full of all kinds of bombastically magniloquent and, so to say, honeyed and inflated phrases. Just in this alone, I shall follow their example, and also begin with such an address, but I shall try not to make it very sugary, as they usually do, owing particularly to their evil wiseacring, by which they titillate the sensibilities of the more or less normal reader. Thus, my dear, highly honoured, strong-willed, and of course very patient sirs, and my much-esteemed, charming and impartial ladies, forgive me, I have omitted the most important, and my in no wise hysterical ladies. I have the honour to inform you that although owing to circumstances that have arisen at one of the last stages of the process of my life, I am now about to write books, yet during the whole of my life I have never written, not only not books or various what are called instructive articles, but also not even a letter in which it has been unfailingly necessary to observe what is called grammaticality, and in consequence, although I am now about to become a professional writer, yet having had no practice at all, either in respect of all the established professional rules and procedures, or in respect of what is called the bon ton literary language, I am constrained to write not at all as ordinary patented writers do, to the form of whose writing you have in all probability become as much accustomed as to your own smell. In my opinion, the trouble with you, in the present instance, is perhaps chiefly due to the fact that while still in childhood, there was implanted in you, and has now become ideally well harmonised with your general psyche, an excellently working automatism for perceiving all kinds of new impressions, thanks to which blessing, you have now, during your responsible life, no need of making any individual effort whatsoever. Speaking frankly, I inwardly, personally discern the centre of my confession not in my lack of knowledge of all the rules and procedures of writers, but in my non-possession of what I have called the bon ton literary language, infallibly required in contemporary life not only from writers, but also from every ordinary mortal. As regards the former, that is to say, my lack of knowledge of the different rules and procedures of writers, I am not greatly disturbed. And I am not greatly disturbed on this account, because such ignorance has already now become in the life of people also in the order of things. Such a blessing arose and now flourishes everywhere on earth, thanks to that extraordinary new disease, of which for the last 20 to 30 years, for some reason or other, especially the majority of those persons from among all the three sexes fall ill, who sleep with half-open eyes, and whose faces are in every respect fertile soil for the growth of every kind of pimple. This strange disease is manifested by this, that if the invalid is somewhat literate, and his rent is paid for 3 months in advance, he, she or it, unfailingly begins to write either some instructive article or a whole book. Well, knowing about this new human disease and its epidemical spread on earth, I, as you should understand, have the right to assume that you have acquired, as the learned medicos would say, immunity to it, and that you will therefore not be palpably indignant at my ignorance of the rules and procedures of writers. This understanding of mine bids me inwardly to make the centre of gravity of my warning my ignorance of the literary language. In self-justification, and also perhaps to diminish the degree of the censure in your waking consciousness of my ignorance of this language, indispensable for contemporary life, I consider it necessary to say, with a humble heart and cheeks flushed with shame, that although I too was taught this language in my childhood, and even though certain of my elders, who prepared me for responsible life, constantly forced me, without sparing or economising, any intimidatory means to learn by rote the host of various nuances which in their totality compose this contemporary delight, yet, unfortunately, of course, for you, of all that I then learned by rote, nothing stuck, and nothing whatsoever has survived for my present activities as a writer. And nothing stuck, as it was quite recently made clear to me, not through any fault of mine, nor through the fault of my former respected and non-respected teachers, but this human labour was spent in vain, owing to one unexpected and quite exceptional event, which occurred at the moment of my appearance on God's earth, and which was, as a certain occultist well known in Europe explained to me after a very minute what is called psychophysico-astrological investigation, that at that moment, through the hole made in the window pane by our crazy lame goat, there poured the vibrations of sound which arose in the neighbour's house from an Edison phonograph, and the midwife had in her mouth a lozenge saturated with cocaine of German make, and moreover not ersatz, and was sucking this lozenge to these sounds without the proper enjoyment. Besides from this event, rare in the everyday life of people, my present position also arose because later on in my preparatory and adult life, as I must confess, I myself guessed after long reflections, according to the method of the German professor Herr Stumpfsinnschmausen, I always avoided, instinctively, as well as automatically, and at times even consciously, that is, on principle, employing this language for intercourse with others. And from such a trifle, and perhaps not a trifle, I manifested thus again, thanks to three data which were formed in my entirety during my preparatory age, about which data I intend to inform you a little later in this same first chapter of my writings. However that may have been, yet the real fact, illuminated from every side, like an American advertisement, and which fact cannot now be changed by any forces, even with the knowledge of the experts in monkey business, is that although I, who have lately been considered by very many people as a rather good teacher of temple dances, have now become today a professional writer, and will, of course, write a great deal, as it has been proper to me since childhood, whenever I do anything, to do a great deal of it. Nevertheless, not having, as you see, the automatically acquired and automatically manifested practice necessary for this, I shall be constrained to write all I have thought out in ordinary, simple, everyday language established by life, without any literary manipulations and without any grammarian wiseacrings. But the pot is not yet full, for I have not yet decided the most important question of all, in which language to write. Although I have begun to write in Russian, nevertheless, as the wisest of the wise, Mullah Nasiruddin would say, in that language you cannot go far. Mullah Nasiruddin, or as he is also called, Hodja Nasiruddin, is, it seems, little known in Europe and America, but he is very well known in all countries of the continent of Asia. This legendary personage corresponds to the American Uncle Sam, or the German Till Eulenspiegel. Numerous tales popular in the East, akin to the wise sayings, some of long standing, and others newly arisen, were ascribed and are still ascribed to this Nasiruddin. The Russian language, it cannot be denied, is very good. I even like it, but only for swapping anecdotes and for use in referring to someone's parentage. The Russian language is like the English, which language is also very good, but only for discussing in smoking rooms while sitting on an easy chair with legs outstretched on another, the topic of Australian frozen meat, or sometimes the Indian question. Both these languages are like the dish which is called in Moscow solyanka, and into which everything goes except you and me, in fact, everything you wish, and even the after-dinner chesma of Scheherazade. It must also be said that owing to all kinds of accidentally, and perhaps not accidentally, formed conditions of my youth, I have had to learn, and moreover very seriously, and of course always with self-compulsion, to speak, read and write a great many languages, and to such a degree of fluency that if, in following this profession unexpectedly forced on me by fate, I decided not to take advantage of the automatism which is acquired by practice, then I could perhaps write in any one of them. But if I set out to use judiciously this automatically acquired automatism, which has become easy from long practice, then I should have to write either in Russian or in Armenian, because the circumstances of my life during the last 2 or 3 decades have been such that I have had for intercourse with others to use, and consequently to have more practice in, just these 2 languages, and to acquire an automatism in respect to them. Oh, the dickens! Even in such a case, one of the aspects of my peculiar psyche, unusual for the normal man, has now already begun to torment the whole of me. And the chief reason for this unhappiness of mine, in my almost already mellow age, results from the fact that since childhood there was implanted in my peculiar psyche, together with numerous other rubbish also unnecessary for contemporary life, such an inherency as always and in everything automatically enjoins the whole of me to act only according to popular wisdom. In the present case, as always in similar as yet indefinite life cases, there immediately comes to my brain, which is for me constructed unsuccessfully to the point of mockery, and is now, as is said, running through it, that saying of popular wisdom, which existed in the life of people of very ancient times, and which has been handed down to our day, formulated in the following words: every stick always has 2 ends. In trying first to understand the basic thought and real significance hidden in this strange verbal formulation, there must, in my opinion, first of all arise in the consciousness of every more or less sane thinking man, the supposition that, in the totality of ideas on which is based, and from which must flow a sensible notion of this saying, lies the truth, cognized by people for centuries, which affirms that every cause occurring in the life of man, from whatever phenomenon it arises, as one of 2 opposite effects of other causes, is in its turn obligatorily moulded also into two quite opposite effects, as for instance, if something obtained from two different causes engenders light, then it must inevitably engender a phenomenon opposite to it, that is to say, darkness, or a factor engendering in the organism of a living creature an impulse of palpable satisfaction also engenders without fail non-satisfaction, of course also palpable, and so on and so forth, always and in everything. Adopting in the same given instance this popular wisdom, formed by centuries and expressed by a stick, which, as was said, indeed has two ends, one end of which is considered good and the other bad, then if I use the aforesaid automatism, which was acquired in me thanks only to long practice, it will be for me personally, of course, very good. But according to this saying, there must result for the reader just the opposite. And what the opposite of good is, even every non-possessor of hemorrhoids must very easily understand. Briefly, if I exercise my privilege and take the good end of the stick, then the bad end must inevitably fall on the reader's head. This may indeed happen, because in Russian, the so to say niceties of philosophical questions cannot be expressed, which questions I intend to touch upon in my writings also rather fully, whereas in Armenian, although this is possible, yet to the misfortune of all contemporary Armenians, the employment of this language for contemporary notions has now already become quite impracticable. In order to alleviate the bitterness of my inner hurt owing to this, I must say that in my early youth, when I became interested in and was greatly taken up with philological questions, I preferred the Armenian language to all others I then spoke, even to my native language. This language was then my favourite chiefly because it was original and had nothing in common with the neighbouring or kindred languages. As the learned philologists say, all of its tonalities were peculiar to it alone, and according to my understanding, even then, it corresponded perfectly to the psyche of the people composing that nation. But the change I have witnessed in that language during the last 30 or 40 years has been such that instead of an original independent language coming to us from the remote past, there has resulted and now exists one which, though also original and independent, yet represents, as might be said, a kind of clownish potpourri of languages, the totality of the consonances of which, falling on the ear of a more or less conscious and understanding listener, sounds just like the tones of Turkish, Persian, French, Kurd and Russian words and still other indigestible and inarticulate noises. Almost the same might be said about my native language, Greek, which I spoke in childhood, and, as might be said, the taste of the automatic associative power of which I still retain. I could now, I dare say, express anything I wish in it, but to employ it for writing is for me impossible, for the simple and rather comical reason that someone must transcribe my writings and translate them into the other languages, and who can do this? It could assuredly be said that even the best expert of modern Greek would understand simply nothing of what I should write in the native language I assimilated in childhood, because my dear compatriots, as they might be called, being also inflamed with the wish at all costs to be like the representatives of contemporary civilization also in their conversation, have during these 30 or 40 years treated my dear native language just as the Armenians, anxious to become Russian intelligentsia, have treated theirs. That Greek language, the spirit and essence of which were transmitted to me by heredity, and the language now spoken by contemporary Greeks, are as much alike as, according to the expression of Mullah Nasruddin, a nail is like a requiem. What is now to be done? Ah me! Never mind, esteemed buyer of my wiseacrings. If only there be plenty of French Armagnac and Caesarian Basturma, I shall find a way out of even this difficult situation. That Greek language, the spirit and essence of which were transmitted to me by heredity, and the language now spoken by contemporary Greeks, are as much alike as, according to the expression of Mulla Nasruddin, a nail is like a requiem. What is now to be done? Ah me! Never mind, esteemed buyer of my wiseacrings. If only there be plenty of French Armagnac and Caesarian Basturma, I shall find a way out of even this difficult situation. I am an old hand at this. In life, I have so often got into difficult situations and out of them that this has become almost a matter of habit for me. Meanwhile, in the present case, I shall write partly in Russian and partly in Armenian, the more readily because among those people always hanging around me, there are several who cerebrate more or less easily in both these languages, and I meanwhile entertain the hope that they will be able to transcribe and translate from these languages fairly well for me. In any case, I again repeat, in order that you should well remember it, but not as you are in the habit of remembering other things, and on the basis of which are accustomed to keeping your word of honour to others or to yourself, that no matter what language I shall use, always and in everything, I shall avoid what I have called the bon ton literary language. In this respect, the ordinary curious fact, and one even in the highest degree worthy of your love of knowledge, perhaps even higher than your usual conception, is that from my earliest childhood, that is to say, since the birth in me of the need to destroy birds' nests and to tease my friend's sisters, there arose in my, as the ancient theosophists called it, planetary body, and moreover, why I don't know, chiefly in the right half, an instinctively involuntary sensation, which right up to that period of my life, when I became a teacher of dancing, was gradually formed into a definite feeling. And then, when thanks to this profession of mine, I came in contact with many people of different types, there began to arise in me also the conviction, with what is called my mind, that these languages are compiled by people, or rather grammarians, who are, in respect of knowledge of the given language, exactly similar to those biped animals whom the esteemed Mulla Nasruddin characterises by the words, "All they can do is wrangle with pigs about the quality of oranges." This kind of people among us who have been turned into, so to say, moths, destroying the good prepared and left for us by our ancestors and by time, have not the slightest notion, and have probably never even heard of, the screamingly obvious fact that, during the preparatory age, there is acquired in the brain functioning of every creature, and of man also, a particular and definite property, the automatic actualization and manifestation of which the ancient Corkulans called the law of association, and that the process of the mentation of every creature, especially man, flows exclusively in accordance with this law. In view of the fact that I have happened here accidentally to touch upon a question which has lately become one of my, so to speak, hobbies, namely the process of human mentation, I consider it possible, without waiting for the corresponding place predetermined by me for the elucidation of this question, to state already now in this first chapter at least something concerning that axiom which has accidentally become known to me, that on earth, in the past, it has been usual in every century that every man in whom there arises the boldness to attain the right to be considered by others and to consider himself a conscious thinker should be informed while still in the early years of his responsible existence that man has in general two kinds of mentation. One kind, mentation by thought, in which words always possessing a relative sense are employed, and the other kind, which is proper to all animals as well as to man, which I would call mentation by form. The second kind of mentation, that is, mentation by form, by which, strictly speaking, the exact sense of all writing must also be perceived, and after conscious confrontation with information already possessed, be assimilated, is formed in people in dependence upon the conditions of geographical locality, climate, time, and, in general, upon the whole environment in which the arising of the given man has proceeded and in which his existence has flowed up to manhood. Accordingly, in the brains of people of different races and conditions, dwelling in different geographical localities, there are formed about one and the same thing or even idea a number of quite independent forms, which during functioning, that is to say, association, evoke in their being some sensation or other, which subjectively conditions a definite picturing, and which picturing is expressed by this, that, or the other word that serves only for its outer subjective expression. That is why each word for the same thing or idea almost always acquires for people of different geographical locality and race a very definite and entirely different, so to say, inner content. In other words, if in the entirety of any man who has arisen and been formed in any locality, from the results of the specific local influences and impressions, a certain form has been composed, and this form evokes in him, by association, the sensation of a definite inner content, and consequently of a definite picturing or notion for the expression of which he employs one or another word which has eventually become habitual, and as I have said, subjective to him, then the hearer of that word, in whose being, owing to different conditions of his arising and growth, there has been formed concerning the given word a form of a different inner content, will always perceive, and of course infallibly understand, that same word in quite another sense. This fact, by the way, can, with attentive and impartial observation, be very clearly established when one is present at an exchange of opinions between persons belonging to two different races, or who arose and were formed in different geographical localities. And so, cheerful and swaggering candidate for a buyer of my wiseacrings, having warned you that I am going to write not as professional writers usually write, but quite otherwise, I advise you, before embarking on the reading of my further expositions, to reflect seriously, and only then to undertake it. If not, I am afraid for your hearing and other perceptive and also digestive organs, which may be already so thoroughly automatized to the literary language of the intelligentsia existing in the present period of time on earth, that the reading of these writings of mine might affect you very, very cacophonously, and from this you might lose your, you know what, your appetite for your favourite dish, and for your psychic specificness, which particularly titillates your inside, and which proceeds in you on seeing your neighbour, the brunette. For such a possibility, ensuing from my language, or rather, strictly speaking, from the form of my mentation, I am, thanks to oft-repeated past experiences, already quite convinced, with this my whole being, as a thoroughbred donkey, is convinced of the right and justice of his obstinacy. Now that I have warned you of what is most important, I am already tranquil about everything further. Even if any misunderstanding should arise on account of my writings, you alone will be entirely to blame, and my conscience will be as clear as, for instance, the ex-Kaiser Wilhelm's. In all probability, you are now thinking that I am, of course, a young man with an auspicious exterior and, as some express it, a suspicious interior, and that, as a novice in writing, I am evidently intentionally being eccentric in the hope of becoming famous and thereby rich. If you indeed think so, then you are very, very mistaken. First of all, I am not young. I have already lived so much that I have been in my life, as it is said, not only through the mill, but through all the grindstones, and secondly, I am, in general, not writing so as to make a career for myself, or so as to plant myself, as is said, firm-footedly, thanks to this profession, which, I must add, in my opinion, provides many openings to become a candidate direct for hell. Assuming, of course, that such people can, in general, by their being, perfect themselves even to that extent, for the reason that knowing nothing whatsoever themselves, they write all kinds of claptrap, and thereby automatically acquiring authority, they become almost one of the chief factors, the totality of which steadily continues year by year, still further to diminish the, without this, already extremely diminished psyche of people. And as regards my personal career, then thanks to all forces high and low and, if you like, even right and left, I have actualized it long ago and have already long been standing on firm feet and even maybe on very good feet. And I moreover am certain that their strength is sufficient for many more years in spite of all my past, present and future enemies. Yes, I think you might as well be told also about an idea which has only just arisen in my madcap brain, and namely, specially to request the printer, to whom I shall give my first book, to print this first chapter of my writings in such a way that anybody may read it before cutting the pages of the book itself, whereupon, on learning that it is not written in the usual manner, that is to say, for helping to produce in one's mentation, very smoothly and easily, exciting images and lulling reveries, he may, if he wishes, without wasting words with the bookseller, return it and get his money back, money perhaps earned by the sweat of his own brow. I shall do this without fail, moreover, because I just now again remember the story of what happened to a Trans-Caucasian Kurd, which story I heard in my quite early youth, and which in subsequent years, whenever I recalled it in corresponding cases, engendered in me an enduring and inextinguishable impulse of tenderness. I think it will be very useful for me, and also for you, if I relate this story to you somewhat in detail. It will be useful chiefly because I have decided already to make the salt, or as contemporary pure-blooded Jewish businessmen would say, the simus of this story, one of the basic principles of that new literary form which I intend to employ for the attainment of the aim I am now pursuing by means of this new profession of mine. This Trans-Caucasian Kurd once set out from his village on some business or other to town, and there in the market he saw in a fruiterer's shop a handsomely arranged display of all kinds of fruit. In this display, he noticed one fruit, very beautiful in both colour and form, and its appearance so took his fancy, and he so longed to try it, that in spite of his having scarcely any money, he decided to buy, without fail, at least one of these gifts of great nature and taste it. Then, with intense eagerness, and with a courage not customary to him, he entered the shop, and pointing with his horny finger to the fruit which had taken his fancy, he asked the shopkeeper its price. The shopkeeper replied that a pound of the fruit would cost 2 cents. Finding that the price was not at all high for what in his opinion was such a beautiful fruit, our curd decided to buy a whole pound. Having finished his business in town, he set off again on foot for home the same day. Walking at sunset over the hills and dales, and willy-nilly perceiving the exterior visibility of those enchanting parts of the bosom of great nature, the common mother, and involuntarily inhaling a pure air, uncontaminated by the usual exhalations of industrial towns, our curd, quite naturally, suddenly felt a wish to gratify himself with some ordinary food also. So sitting down by the side of the road, he took from his provision bag some bread and the fruit he had bought, which looked so good to him, and leisurely began to eat. But, horror of horrors! Very soon everything inside him began to burn. But in spite of this, he kept on eating. And this hapless biped creature of our planet kept on eating, thanks only to that particular human inherency which I mentioned at first, the principle of which I intended, when I decided to use it as the foundation of the new literary form I have created, to make, as it were, a guiding beacon, leading me to one of my aims in view, and the sense and meaning of which, moreover, you will, I am sure, soon grasp. Of course, according to the degree of your comprehension, during the reading of any subsequent chapter of my writings, if, of course, you take the risk and read further, or it may perhaps be that even at the end of this first chapter, you will already smell something. And so, just at the moment when our curd was overwhelmed by all the unusual sensations proceeding within him from this strange repast on the bosom of nature, there came along the same road a fellow villager of his, one reputed by those who knew him to be very clever and experienced. And seeing that the whole face of the curd was aflame, that his eyes were streaming with tears, and that, in spite of this, as if intent upon the fulfilment of his most important duty, he was eating real red pepper pods, he said to him, "What are you doing, you Jericho jackass? You'll be burnt alive. Stop eating that extraordinary product, so unaccustomed for your nature." But our curd replied, "No, for nothing on earth will I stop. Didn't I pay my last 2 cents for them? Even if my soul departs from my body, I shall still go on eating." Whereupon our resolute curd, it must of course be assumed that he was such, did not stop, but continued eating the red pepper pods. After what you have just perceived, I hope there may already be arising in your mentation a corresponding mental association which should, as a result, effectuate in you, as it sometimes happens to contemporary people, that which you call, in general, understanding. And that in the present case, you will understand just why I, well knowing and having many a time commiserated with this human inherency, the inevitable manifestation of which is that if anybody pays money for something, he is bound to use it to the end, was animated in the whole of my entirety with the idea, arisen in my mentation, to take every possible measure in order that you, as is said, my brother in appetite and in spirit, in the event of your proving to be already accustomed to reading books, though of all kinds, yet nevertheless only those written exclusively in the aforesaid language of the intelligentsia, having already paid money for my writings, and learning only afterwards that they are not written in the usual, convenient, and easily read language, should not be compelled, as a consequence of the said human inherency, to read my writings through to the end at all costs, as our poor Transcaucasian Kurd was compelled to go on with his eating of what he had fancied for its appearance alone, that not to be joked with noble red pepper. And so, for the purpose of avoiding any misunderstanding through this inherency, the data for which are formed in the entirety of contemporary man, thanks evidently to his frequenting of the cinema, and thanks also to his never missing an opportunity of looking into the left eye of the other sex, I wish that this commencing chapter of mine should be printed in the said manner, so that everyone can read it through without cutting the pages of the book itself. Otherwise, the bookseller will, as is said, cavil, and will, without fail, again turn out to act in accordance with the basic principle of booksellers in general, formulated by them in the words, "You'll be more of a simpleton than a fisherman if you let go of the fish which has swallowed the bait, and will decline to take back a book whose pages you have cut." I have no doubt of this possibility. Indeed, I fully expect such lack of conscience on the part of booksellers. And the data for the engendering of my certainty as to this lack of conscience on the part of these booksellers were completely formed in me when, while I was a professional Indian fakir, I needed for the complete elucidation of a certain ultra-philosophical question also to become familiar, among other things, with the associative process for the manifestation of the automatically constructed psyche of contemporary booksellers and of their salesmen when palming off books on their buyers. Knowing all this and having become, since the misfortune which befell me, habitually just and fastidious in the extreme, I cannot help repeating, or rather, I cannot help again warning you, and even imploringly advising you, before beginning to cut the pages of this first book of mine, to read through very attentively, and even more than once, this first chapter of my writings. But in the event that, notwithstanding this warning of mine, you should nevertheless wish to become acquainted with the further contents of my expositions, then there is already nothing else left for me to do but to wish you with all my genuine soul a very, very good appetite, and that you may digest all that you read, not only for your own health, but for the health of all those near you. I said with my genuine soul, because recently living in Europe and coming in frequent contact with people who on every appropriate and inappropriate occasion are fond of taking in vain every sacred name which should belong only to man's inner life, that is to say, with people who swear to no purpose, I being, as I have already confessed, a follower in general not only of the theoretical, as contemporary people have become, but also of the practical sayings of popular wisdom, which have become fixed by the centuries, and therefore of the saying which in the present case corresponds to what is expressed by the words, "When you are in Rome, do as Rome does," decided, in order not to be out of harmony with the custom established here in Europe of swearing in ordinary conversation, and at the same time to act according to the commandment which was enunciated by the holy lips of Saint Moses, not to take the holy names in vain, to make use of one of those examples of the newly baked, fashionable languages of the present time, namely English. And so from then on, I began on necessary occasions to swear by my English soul. The point is that in this fashionable language, the words soul and the bottom of your foot, also called soul, are pronounced and even written almost alike. I do not know how it is with you, who are already partly candidate for a buyer of my writings, but my peculiar nature cannot, even with a great mental desire, avoid being indignant at the fact manifested by people of contemporary civilization that the very highest in man, particularly beloved by our common Father Creator, can really be named and indeed very often before even having made clear to oneself what it is, can be understood to be that which is lowest and dirtiest in man. Well, enough of philologizing. Let us return to the main task of this initial chapter, destined, among other things, on the one hand, to stir up the drowsy thoughts in me, as well as in the reader, and on the other, to warn the reader about something. And so I have already composed in my head the plan and sequence of the intended expositions. But what form they will take on paper, I, speaking frankly, myself do not as yet know with my consciousness, but with my subconsciousness, I already definitely feel that on the whole it will take the form of something which will be, so to say, hot, and will have an effect on the entirety of every reader, such as the red pepper pods had on the poor Transcaucasian Kurt. Now that you have become familiar with the story of our common countryman, the Transcaucasian Kurd, I already consider it my duty to make a confession, and hence, before continuing this first chapter, which is by way of an introduction to all my further predetermined writings, I wish to bring to the knowledge of what is called your pure waking consciousness the fact that in the writings following this chapter of warning, I shall expound my thoughts intentionally and in such sequence and with such logical confrontation that the essence of certain real notions may of themselves automatically, so to say, go from this waking consciousness, which most people in their ignorance mistake for the real consciousness, but which I affirm and experimentally prove is the fictitious one, into what you call the subconscious, which ought to be, in my opinion, the real human consciousness, and thereby themselves mechanically bring about that transformation which should in general proceed in the entirety of a man and give him, from his own conscious mentation, the results he ought to have, which are proper to man and not merely to single or double-brained animals. I decided to do this without fail, so that this initial chapter of mine, predetermined, as I have already said, to awaken your consciousness, should fully justify its purpose, and reaching not only your, in my opinion, as yet only fictitious consciousness, but also your real consciousness. That is to say, what you call your subconscious might, for the first time, compel you to reflect actively. In the entirety of every man, irrespective of his heredity and education, there are formed two independent consciousnesses, which in their functioning as well as in their manifestations have almost nothing in common. One consciousness is formed from the perception of all kinds of accidental, or on the part of others intentionally produced, mechanical impressions, among which must also be counted the consonances of various words, which are indeed, as is said, empty. And the other consciousness is formed from the, so to say, already previously formed material results, transmitted to him by heredity, which have become blended with the corresponding parts of the entirety of a man, as well as from the data arising from his intentional evoking of the associative confrontations of these materialized data already in him. The whole totality of the formation, as well as the manifestation, of this second human consciousness, which is none other than what is called the subconscious, and which is formed from the materialized results of heredity and the confrontations actualized by one's own intentions, should, in my opinion, formed by many years of my experimental elucidations during exceptionally favorably arranged conditions, predominate in the common presence of a man.